Konnichiwa, and welcome to Learning Digital Photography, episode 46. My name is Jason Anderson, I'm your host, and with me on the show this week is the illustrious Martin Bailey, fresh over from Japan, so we're talking overseas this week. Martin, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Jason, and konnichiwa to you too.
Did I say that right? Is it konnichiwa?
It was perfect. Okay. You sounded like you just came straight out of the Black Rain.
Straight out of the Black Rain. Well, you know, I'm have Japanese heritage from my Finnish and Spanish roots or wherever. But, well, welcome to the show. Thank you very much for coming on the show. We've got a lot to talk about this week, folks, so stick around. We're going to have a bunch of news stories to talk about. There's a lot of news going on in photography right now. You'll get a little insight from us here. We've also got your questions and answers on the show, and we're also going to talk to Martin Bailey about his past and what he's doing with photography overseas in Japan. This is all going to be about cultures colliding. Don't go away. We'll be back in just a moment. Learning Digital Photography. A couple news items that we have on this week's show. I mentioned this on last week's show, but it bears mentioning again, the third annual Worldwide Photo Walk has been announced by Scott Kelby and the clan over at National Association of Photoshop Professionals. This one is announced, what was it, Martin, 2 weeks ago? Was it 2 weeks ago Monday?
About 2 weeks ago, yeah.
Yeah, I think it was about 2 weeks ago when Scott Kelby announced it on his blog, and there's a website called WorldwidePhotoWalk.com. So you can go on the WorldwidePhotoWalk.com website, find out all about it. For those of you that may not have visited the site yet or want to just know a little snippet here on the show, I've been participating in it myself since the first year. It really is a great experience. It's less about photography than you would think. It's more about socializing with others who are into photography. It's still about photography, but it's more about socializing. So you meet up with other people, and you just go walk around taking pictures, and you can share techniques and tips and tricks about composition, how to do post-processing, all that kind of stuff. It's a great way to network, great way to socialize. For anyone that's going to be in Denver, let me know, and I'll share the details of the walk that I'll be on with you. Otherwise, check for cities in your own area. And since this literally is a worldwide photo walk event, you can check no matter where you are in the world. There was bound to be a photo walk near you somewhere unless you're in, I don't know, the mountains of Kamchatka or something like that. There probably isn't a photo walk going on there. But it's a great photo walk. There's a lot of super cool prizes going on there, too. So stop over to the website, check everything out. Martin, are they doing those in Japan?
Yeah, it's worldwide.
Are you going to be hosting one, or are you participating in one?
I've just applied to host one, and I haven't had an answer yet. But I'm hoping to run one in like Harajuku and the Meiji Jingu. It's just a big shrine, a famous shrine in Tokyo.
Very cool.
And then maybe walk around to Yoyogi Park. Lots of street photography, people photography, stuff like that. I hope I'm accepted because it'll be a good walk, and it's the first time I've done.
Yeah, I think given your locale, you'll definitely be accepted. That'd be very cool to see some of the pictures that come out of there. Because from everything I've heard and seen about Japan is just beautiful. I mean, that place is just gorgeous.
It's a beautiful place. Yeah, I mean, I love living here, and so I'm lucky.
Yeah, and how long have you lived there now? You've been there how many years now?
I went back to England for 3 years in the middle, but I first came here in 91, so 19 years ago. And then from 97 to 2000, I went back to England for 3 years, and then I've been back here for 10 years after that. Yeah, yeah.
Very cool. Oh, I'm sorry, we're still in the news, aren't we? Maybe I should get back to the other news segments. Well, the other big piece of news that happened was that Lightroom version 3 was just announced last week, Monday. So for those of you that may not be up to speed on this yet or are considering diving in, this is very cool, very exciting, because we were in Lightroom 3 Beta 2. So we were on, before that it was Lightroom 2.7, and then they released a beta for Lightroom 3, and then they released a second version of the beta, and they just announced the full version of Lightroom 3, which is now available for download over at the Adobe website, and if you're not ready to pay for it, you can get a 30-day trial. If you want to get it, you can go ahead and get it. The full retail price is, I think, $299 or something like that. A lot of really cool new features in it. The ones that are getting the most attention are the tethering. There's, I'm running blank right now. But I know the big one that I've been most interested in is automatic tethering. And I think that was available in the beta as well. Had you had a chance to play with the beta when it was out, Martin? Do you remember what the other
one? I have. I've not done a lot with it yet, but I really like the changes that are being made. I like the new import dialogues and the way all of that works. And, you know, I mean, I'm just such a Lightroom freak. I've been using it since the very first beta when the photography community helped out to sort of, you know, with all of the feedback to make it what it is and continue to do. I love Lightroom.
It's definitely part of your workflow too, then, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely.
I think a lot of photographers are jumping on board the quote-unquote Lightroom fan train or bandwagon, whatever you want to call it. Mm. But it's just, it's been so wonderful. The big new features that I recall, because I haven't had too much of a chance to play with it, but there were five or six big new features. One was the enhanced watermarking, and I think that was in the beta as well. I don't remember if that was in the beta, but there was enhanced watermarking, the tethered shooting. The video slideshows was a big one for me, and that was I know that one was in the beta too, where you could create a slideshow and then attach music, because a lot of when before Lightroom 3, you couldn't do an actual slideshow. It would export a slideshow as a PDF file, and now you can do it as an actual video, as like an MOV file, which is the QuickTime movie format. So you can do that now in the full version of Lightroom 3. Very cool feature, especially if you want to present your images to a client or to a group of people. It makes it very handy to have that kind of control over the display environment, so you're not just like showing someone a picture or something like that.
You know what? I'm really looking forward, and I believe I've not played around with the production, you know, the final version yet, but I was really looking forward to being able to at least sort of manage and handle video in Lightroom 3 as well.
That's right. That's another feature of it where we can manage your not just your stills but your video files as well in Lightroom 3. And that was actually super cool. That when they put that out in the beta and I played with it, it was really neat because you could actually play it inside of Lightroom.
I didn't realize that even worked in the beta. Maybe the second beta it did. I just haven't played with that so much. But that's something that I'm really looking forward to doing, because I've been dropping my video files into the same folders as my photos for the last year.
Right.
And it's like I just want to grab them and start to really use them in the same sort of content management system.
Exactly. And that's the beautiful part of it, is Lightroom really has become pretty much a complete content management system. Right. Where you can manage multiple types of assets, because up until version 3 now, it was just still pictures, and now you can do the video files as well. Now, you can't edit. So for those of you that haven't tried the beta yet, you can't edit your video. It's not a video editor. It's more just a, like Martin said, it's a content management system, or a CMS. So you can do your stills, you can do your videos. I can't wait until they also include PDFs.
Yeah,
so that'll be cool as well.
You can output slideshows as PDF, right?
You
could do that in two, so I'm sure you can.
That's a good point. You probably could manage PDFs. I had not tried yet. That's interesting.
You know what? Just as an aside, you mentioned video. I picked up the suite, the CS5 suite, recently, and Adobe have switched now for Premiere Pro. They only have 64-bit, I think because they're tapping into that, the video editing in Premiere Pro is just amazing now. You know, you can preview live. I mean, before it was always very jittery and the sound would break off or break up every so often. But now Premiere Pro and CS5, that's pretty amazing. So I won't miss. I mean, some light editing ability in Lightroom might be nice, but Premiere Pro is where I'll jump to that. So as long as I
can. That's great. That's fantastic. And I think the thing that's cool about that is the fact that a lot of applications are moving to a 64-bit module. Clearly, 32-bit will eventually become a legacy format or setup for operating systems and software at some point. It still is around to a certain degree for a lot of it, just because there's been so much development in that arena, and 64-bit is fairly new. But 64-bit is the wave of the future. It's become stable enough and reliable enough to where people are starting to develop for it. on major commercial apps, like you said, with Adobe Premiere Pro. We have Lightroom on 64-bit. I think Photoshop CS5 is on 64-bit. So a lot of applications go on the 64-bit route. And like you said, you can see a huge performance increase, especially with things like video.
Right. So, yeah, that's amazing.
A great, fantastic. Just, and it decreases downtime. For people that are saying, well, what's the big deal? Well, it decreases the amount of time you have to spend in post-production.
Sure, yeah.
You know, that's the big deal. You know, if you want to be a photographer, that means you don't, or a videographer, it means you don't want to be spending your time in front of a computer. You want to be out shooting pictures or shooting video.
That's
what makes that such a big deal, because it really can cut your production time literally in half.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, I mean, that actually, that's another good point. When I just did a video, just a simple 5-minute video of the moon moving across the frame at 1,872 millimeters focal length. The last video I did was 8.5 minutes, and that took 50 minutes to render or to encode. And the moon video is 5.5 minutes, and it took 9 minutes to encode.
Wow.
It's a simpler video. There's not as much detail, but it's greatly reduced encoding time as well.
Yeah,
so
it's just proof so much putting right there. So yeah. that was another big thing in the introduction of Lightroom 3, is the video management capability. You can export videos. The tethered shooting, the noise reduction and noise sharpening quality has also been, not noise sharpening, the noise reduction, image sharpening. Let's sharpen that noise.
Yeah, sharpen the noise.
Let's sharpen some noise pixels and stuff. That'd be awesome. No, but that was also available in the beta too, where they just really ramped up the quality of noise reduction as well as the quality of sharpening. It's luminance sharpening, I think they call it, and color sharpening.
Yeah, there's a couple stuff. It's very, very cool stuff.
And the cool thing about that, because people are still asking, well, what's the big deal with that? The big deal with that is that until this version, you used to have like a workflow that would incorporate something like Photoshop or a third-party plugin like Noise Ninja or Neat Image or anything like that. The quality of the sharpening and the noise reduction in Lightroom has gotten to the point where I'd say, I almost want to say, because I haven't run tests or anything yet, but I almost want to say, you don't need a third-party plugin anymore. I don't think I would need it for my photography. Of course, I'm not a commercial photographer. I don't do a lot of professional demonstrations, so I haven't really looked at it to the nth degree like that. But for my uses, and I would say for most people's uses, you're probably not going to need the third-party products as far as noise reduction goes anymore.
Mm. Well, you know what? I was recently, I had an order for a print, which I shot at ISO 1600, and it was good. It's the 1D Mark IV that I used, so you know it was relatively low grain. But I shot this video, photo at 1600 ISO, and when I came to print it, the grain was visible.
Yeah.
And although I'm a Nik software proponent, love their stuff, Silver FX Pro and everything. Mm-hmm. And I also have used Define for many years. For a year or so, not many years. But I actually, the reason that I installed the Beta 3 of Lightroom on my production machine recently was so that I could, you know, give the new sharpening, I'm doing the same as you, the noise reduction a try. I think I did use the sharpening as well, but I loaded the beta to try the new noise reduction. And in my opinion, for that particular image, I mean, like you just said, you haven't run like proper tests and things. I haven't either. But my first impressions, and you know, I mean, with this one image in particular, I definitely thought that Lightroom 3 was beating Define. Just for a quick sort of a quick fix, it really brought it removed the noise incredibly well, and it didn't, you know, there was none of that sort of silky overlay sort of look. It was really nice.
Right.
So I'm looking forward to using that. And to me, even if it's not quite as good, if it's that good, and it saves me doing a round trip out into a third party plugin,
right,
and then coming back in with a TIFF, you know, a TIFF file or something like that,
right,
then that to me is worth even a slight drop in quality. But I didn't see that. I'm really looking forward to seeing how that holds on various types of images.
Yeah, and see, and that's the thing, is I really didn't see much of a drop in quality myself. And if you zoom in, the way you can tell is if you zoom into 100% and you move that slider scale up for the for noise reduction or for image sharpening,
right,
you can see the algorithms taking the noise out. And if you're zoomed in at 100% on just that little square inside Lightroom, you can see the quality of the image of that, just that one little square.
Right.
It's kind of looked that good across the whole scene, too.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Because when you go bigger, the less you'll notice minor artifact or anything like that. So if you're not seeing it at 100% scale, of course you're not going to see it at the 25% scale.
Yeah.
And how many people are really going to go up to a photograph anyway and look at it, you know, at a 100% square crop? You know, most people don't do that. Most people look at a photo while it's hanging on a wall in an art gallery or someone's photo gallery somewhere. I think it's only the pencil people like us that do that kind of thing. The average consumer isn't going to look at things on that level.
The other thing, I mean, I do, I pixel peep, and I'm proud of the sharpness of most of my images, but I... The thing is that you have to remember, when you're looking at it on a screen, you're looking at it at 72 dpi, and that's enough for a monitor. Yeah. But then when you print it, you're probably going to be printing at 300, 240, 300 dpi. And so, you know, you're automatically reducing it to the point where you can't really tell the difference at that, at, you know, even on like a 13 by 19 print.
Yeah.
But, you know, so, but I mean, you're definitely using that as a way of checking to make sure. To me, it's a perfectly, you know, legitimate thing to do.
Oh, yeah, I know a lot of people that do that too, because that really is the ultimate litmus test, if you will, for the quality of sharpness on photos. You
know, right.
How does the end product look? Well, what is the end product? Is the end product on a screen, or is the end product on paper, or is it a huge billboard up in New York City, or, you know, Tokyo, Japan, or wherever? You know, if the person's looking at it from a mile away as they're driving down the highway, they're not going to see the little bit of grain behind the person's hair over on the far right-hand side, you know.
Right.
So it's always got to think about the output and how it's going to be viewed, because that's what you want to sharpen for. And the sharpening and the noise reduction in Lightroom 3, hands down, best native, I think I can say that, the best native sharpening I've seen in any program to date.
Yeah,
so,
I agree.
I'm kind of putting my leg out there, though. I hope no one comes up and says, well, you know, such and such a program really does this better. So I'm sure someone will.
Somebody may do, but like I said, like I was saying, you know, I mean, I was talking about the quality earlier. It's really in comparison to something else. And in my mind, even if when you do your sharpening the third-party tool, if it's slightly better but not a lot better, I would still prefer to do it in the program rather than doing that round trip. So.
Exactly. And that round, you hit the nail on the head right there. The round trip is really what the difficulty is in post-production, because you don't want to have to do that. You know, I think most people would agree that, you know, I don't want to have 20 million programs on my computer to process 20 pictures.
The other thing with me is that I try to do as much as I can in Lightroom, because it's non-destructive and it keeps your raw files in the base.
Right.
And then when you've got the moment you go out of Lightroom and you create a TIFF or a Photoshop file, of course, if it's Photoshop, you can use layers, but if you're creating a TIFF, it's all baked in. And so, you know, with raw, if you do all of your processing or the majority of your processing against a raw file, then every time, you know, when ACR 7 and ACR 8 and ACR 9 come out and start making a better job, you can go back and you're automatically reprocessing your files with an updated and a usually better raw program.
Right.
And the algorithms are getting better. So, you know, keep it all. I mean, even dust removal, do it all in Lightroom, because then you've got it recorded against the image, and then all of the good things that are coming up in the future years are going to be available still.
And that's a beautiful point there, too, is the non-destructive methodology that Lightroom uses to handle your image processing. And this is something that we talked about last week with Rob, where Rob made a good point that Lightroom doesn't really edit your image. It doesn't really ever touch your image. It just looks at the raw data for your image, looks at the edits you want to make, and then stores that information, like you just said, in a database.
Right.
So, and it's a very different process from... Oh, I'm sorry. I should speak your language. Different process, because you're from England. So it's a different process in image editing, where it doesn't touch the image. So.
Right.
Sorry, I had to give a little bit there.
No, so how would you say the plural of process?
processes.
Okay, that's good. That's good. I was hoping it wasn't going to be processes, because a lot of people say processes, and that's another one.
That's not, I just had to get rid of them. I'm very happy to have Martin on the show, because we've mentioned this before we went live, but we've been trying to coordinate this podcast chat for about 6 months, I think.
Easily.
Back in December before the holidays, and schedules didn't match up. So the fact that we actually got the chance to sit down and talk to each other was very exciting. So I'm giving him every nudge that I've thought of for the last 6 months. So
you continue, just keep it coming, Jason. I'm loving it.
You're sounding right back at me too, which is probably the embarrassing part of it all. All right. Well, the last bit of news that came out in the last couple of weeks was this new plugin that I saw for Pro Show Gold. For those of you that have been using alternative, or like we had mentioned, third-party software to do various things, Pro Show Gold is a popular slideshow and movie creation software set. And you can get that over at photodex.com. If you're driving somewhere, don't write it down. I'll put a link in the show notes. But they have a new plugin available for Lightroom. So if you do a lot of work in Pro Show Gold, you do a lot of work in Lightroom, there's a free plugin now that you can download and put inside of Lightroom. And I'm pretty sure this will work in Lightroom 3. I tried it in the 3 Beta 2. I haven't had a chance to try it in the production version yet. But it's a pretty cool plugin. I don't know if you've... Have you ever done any work with Pro Show Gold, Martin?
Yeah, I love it. I've done... The last three, I create a portfolio called The Nature of Japan, and I created the last three versions of that in Pro Show. I actually use Pro Show Producer, but because I like to be able to, with Pro Show Producer, you can do branding on your CDs and things, various things like that. But I haven't used the Lightroom plugin. I have the old version of the plugin, and I've had it installed for a long while. I haven't really used it because I like to sort of really, get into the program and, control exactly how all of the, the movement and the scaling of the slides is. I like to be able to control it. So say if the birds are moving one way across the screen, I'll make it expand that way. And if it's a landscape that looks the way, so I like the control of actually using the Pro Show producer. The full blown.
Right.
Product rather than
and that's actually hit the nail on the head there, because that's what, and I'm sure a lot of people would ask initially, well, why would you even use Pro Show versus Lightroom for producing slideshows? And that Martin just hit on the perfect example right there, because you do get more granular control over how the slideshow is produced. Mm. If you want just a quick and dirty slideshow, you can do that in Lightroom. It'll show you the pictures, it'll tap the music, it'll make it a video file all nice and pretty. But there's a lot of different effects that can enhance a slideshow that are available in something like Pro Show Gold or Pro Show Producer that you can't do in Lightroom. So having that plug-in for Lightroom is a handy thing, because it can tie the two together.
So, yeah. You know what? For a quick slideshow, then I think it's probably going to be great to be able to do that from Lightroom, especially if you can embed video clips and if Pro Show works with video clips as well.
Ooh, I haven't tried that.
You know what? If anyone from Pro Show listens to this, there's only one problem with Pro Show Gold or Pro Show Producer.
Okay.
And I'm going to start with the really good thing about it. You on a Windows machine, you have a plugin that when you put these Pro Show slideshows onto a website, you have a plugin that allows you. The files are tiny. Because it saves all of the image data and does it all mathematically. So the files are tiny. And then what you can do is you can right-click it and you can go full screen and have really, really good quality video. But it's tiny. You're talking maybe 15, 20 megabytes for a five-minute slideshow.
Really? That's super nice.
It is. But here's the thing, and here's what the people at Pro Show Gold need to listen to, and I'm sure they get to this all the time.
Okay.
Create a Mac version, an Apple Mac version of your plugin, because if this thing does not work on a Mac, it only works on Windows machines.
Right.
If that worked on a Mac, if they had a browser plugin to view these videos on a Mac, they would beat every because Flash and all of that, there's all of this controversy about Flash at the moment. Obviously people don't want to have lots of different plugins, but for what it saves you, being able to do that, if it was totally platform independent, the browser plugin, then they'd be world beaters. So just wow. Someone's listening, do that, guys.
Well, if someone's listening, I'll be quite flattered, but I'm not sure they're hanging on every word of my podcast. But if you are listening, it's a good point. And the same point could also be made for Camtasia. And I know that they say Camtasia came out for the Mac, but it's not the same. It's so much more limited in functionality on the Mac. And Camtasia, for those of you that don't know, is where you can do screen captures.
Yeah.
So if you're doing video tutorials or things like that, or you want to show someone how to do certain things, like it's great for teaching workshops, that kind of stuff, through online learning, regardless of whatever you're teaching. It's fantastic for that. But that's been Windows only as well for the longest time. They did come out with the Mac version. I tried it and wasn't impressed, though. It really doesn't have the same feature set that it did on the Windows side. So.
I've not used it on a Mac. I do use it on Windows and totally agree. Excellent product.
Yeah, it's probably one of the better products I think that they have on the Windows platform, is Camtasia.
Does it usually take you this long to get through your photo news section?
No.
Sorry about this.
No, that's okay. You're totally fine. And actually, I asked Martin before I went live if he wanted to stick around for the whole show, if we just wanted to do a short segment. Because a lot of times people have other schedules they need to move on to, and he said he was willing to stick around for the whole show. So I said, I'm not going to do any mixdowns. So we're not going to break things up down this show. This is going to be all one huge segment. We're not going to have any segues between anything here now. So you're not going to hear those little teasers that I insert in GarageBand. So for the listening audience, this is non-stop entertainment tonight, man. Or this morning, or whenever you're listening. We're going to go until we stop. No breaks. No breaks, no rest for the weary. But that was it for the news, though. We had three news segments, so that is it for the news segments. And I want to also thank Martin for contributing to that as well, because it's always nice to get some feedback and dialogue from others. So thanks for sticking around to help out with that. But
not at all.
Moving from that, we wanted to actually take some time and actually talk to you about your experiences. And a big part of, I have to admit, the big part of why I wanted to get you on the show is because I've never been to Japan, and, you know, Canon is based there, Nikon, you know, there's so much of the photography gear that's produced in the world comes out of that area.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's whether it's the SLRs or the point shoots or, you know, whatever. I would imagine that there are a lot more photographers, proportionally speaking, than there are in the U.S. Do you find that to be the case, that everyone has a camera?
Yeah, I've got a theory, actually, that the Japanese government, when you reach 60 in Japan, they issue you with a beige floppy hat and a photography vest, and they give you a ticket that you can take to any camera shop and get any three white lenses.
Oh, there you go.
Cause it literally,
is it the big ticket that's like 10 inches wide and hangs down?
Yeah, it must be. Because, I mean, you obviously, no people until you're 60, you don't get to see these things. But every time I go to Hokkaido, well, I mean, I run workshops, nature photography workshops up in Hokkaido. And when you go up there, there's like everybody is, well, not everybody, but, you know, a lot of people are like their retirement age. And you can have like a 70-year-old little old lady or you know, little old guy, and they're walking around, and they've all got like 300mm f/2.8s and 70-200s, and some of them they're walking around with 500mm lenses, and yeah, they've got this gear that a lot of people, obviously it's because of the disposable they've worked hard all of their life, especially the elderly sort of Japanese have worked incredibly hard to sort of, I mean, that's why Japan has become such a big financial, it might be a little bit stagnant at the moment, but they were like the second biggest economy in the world for the longest time.
Right.
And it's because they worked so hard, and they've got a lot of, they've put the hours in to make it possible to do that. So, of course, if anyone doesn't know me, And thinks I'm being serious here, of course, this is just a joke. But
sure I agree with that being a joke. I've read a couple of, or not read, but I've heard a couple other podcasts where they've talked about the work ethic in various countries. And I would actually have to agree with you that I think, for the most part, the work ethic of most Americans, and this is coming from an American, we're not the most.
Well, let me just put the record straight first, Ed. What I mean is about the ticket where you get the three white lenses. That's a joke.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that bit.
They don't get free lenses.
Right, and they probably pay for their own beige floppy hats and photography vests. But
well, I don't know about the hat. The hat might be.
that's probably a government issue.
that's probably the exception to the rule.
No, they do work incredibly hard. As an outsider, I know that people in America work incredibly hard as well, and the younger generation in Japan are not working as hard as the middle to elderly Japanese did, without a doubt.
I think that's more of a generational thing as well.
So, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Regardless of where you are in the world, I find myself today saying, "These, you know, kids, turn your music down," and then I catch myself and I'm like, oh, "What's happened to me? I'm turning into my father. Oh my god."
Tell me about it.
I just told someone to turn their music down. I didn't just say that.
Me and my wife say that sort of stuff all the time. You know, when we were younger, we were doing all of that stuff, and we thought it was so cool. It's like when you're 16 and you're on a train, you think everybody wants to hear your conversation.
Yeah.
But nobody wants to hear your conversation, and yet you turn the volume up so loud that everyone in the train car can hear you. And it's, I don't know. It's just there's various things that we generally turn into our parents. And
funny thing is, when I was 16, I didn't even have a cell phone. Cell phones weren't invented yet.
Yeah, well, even talking amongst yourselves, you know, two people sitting on a train, they turn it up so loud that it drives you crazy sometimes.
Well, yeah, that'll just turn the old fogey on me, because I'll be like, well, I remember when I was a kid, we didn't have these during technology cell phone thingamabobs. And I remember actually a movie from the 1980s. I think it was Pretty Woman. I remember Richard Gere in this movie, and he had a cell phone. But it was a brick. I mean, it was like a foot long, like 4 inches wide, and it weighed 50 pounds. But we were like, he's got one of those mobile phones. Look at how cool that is.
And the original phones, I saw this on a TV program the other week, they had a strap on them. They were like a leather case that was a bag, and they were maybe a foot deep, you know, and then the phone was like resting on the top, and it was a normal phone receiver with the coiled, you know, cable.
It was crazy. They had a little pack for the battery there, too.
Right. Well, most of it was the battery along the bottom, but they were huge. So, yeah. I mean, they weren't really mobile phones.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you're absolutely right there. It wasn't mobile at all, just because they weighed so much and they were so huge. Well, tell me the other question I had for you, because this has been a hot-button topic in the States more recently, this issue of, you know, because more and more people are getting cameras in the States every day, and I'm seeing a lot of stories of people getting, well, harassed. You know, in a post on the level world, people are going around saying, you can't take pictures of the government buildings, you can't take pictures of this, you can here, but you can't use a tripod, and you can if it's non-professional gear, but you can't if it is professional gear, and professional gear is a lens that's over 4 inches long, or, you know, just crazy rules that they're going to have coming up with in the States today, and I'm wondering, do you see that same kind of trend overseas? You know, is that a similar trend? Are there more legal hassles going around now than previously? You said you've been here for, what, 20 years now? So that's,
I definitely, in Japan, we don't have the hassles that you're seeing in the West at the moment. And like, as an example, a few weeks ago, I couldn't sleep. I got up really early, and I went out and I took a walk around near the Imperial Palace, where the Emperor of Japan lives.
Oh, wow.
If you can hear some noise, for some reason, my PC is getting a little bit excited. I'll try and remove a few processes to get it. I won't kill the Skype process.
Don't kill that. We've got a great show going right now. Don't kill that process.
I went over to the Imperial Palace, and there was a policeman. They have these police boxes in Japan where it's literally just a small hook where a policeman stands to do his job. And I was photographing the palace and the grounds, and he came out and he was looking across. I saw him looking at me, and I just walked a little bit further along, said good morning, and we ended up had a really nice conversation. He was telling me what all of the bridges were called and why they were called that, and then he went back into his police box and he came out and bought some photocopies of some historical photos, and he was showing me pictures from 100 years ago, how it looked then, and we had this really, really nice conversation. And then when I walked away, he said, "You come back now." And it was really sort of just a nice conversation. He told me where he lived. He told me how long he'd been working there and all of this. And I didn't solicit a lot of this. We just had a really nice chat. And so, and that's in, like, the center of Japan where the emperor lives, and he was just being amazing.
I don't think I could walk up to the White House and do that.
Well, I mean, obviously, there are places where you might get, you might get questioned, but they definitely would not get harassed.
Right.
Contrary to belief, probably from things that happened in during the war and that, people think that Japan can be a nasty place and all of that. But the people are the most friendly and beautiful sort of people in the world. And I mean, that's one of the reasons why I love living here. And they're just so kind, and I just think that if you've got any misconceptions or any sort of ill feelings about Japan, and obviously people have their scars, and there are reasons for all of this. Although a lot of the propaganda, a lot of the stories that we hear, actually things like that happen from both sides, but you don't hear about them from the other side. If you've got any of those sort of ill feelings, just spend a few weeks here and get to know the place a little bit more, because you'll find it's a beautiful country.
I would love to come and spend a couple of weeks in Japan. That's awesome. And you said you were just out walking around shooting. So do you see a lot more street photography in Japan? Do more people just go walking around with cameras to do little photography projects?
Photography is, and I've lived here for so long that I don't know how popular it is in other countries at the moment, but generally, it's very popular. The majority of people have got at least a half-decent camera. And people, when you go to areas that are popular, like in the cherry blossom seasons or in autumn when you get the beautiful colour on the trees, the places are packed, and there's a lot of people turn out there. I generally make sure that I go to famous or well-known locations on weekdays and like really early, and even then you're often vying for a position to shoot from. So it's very popular. But street photography, I don't do a lot of street photography myself at the moment, but people are much more open to photographs, people having their photograph taken than most countries, I think, just because cameras are so they're such commonplace. I don't do much street photography. And the main reason for that is that I'm a little bit sort of anxious about going up to people and asking them to take the photograph, but the other reason is that when you do that here, you generally what will happen is they'll stand to attention. They'll either put their hands down by the sides and give you like a standing to attention pose, or they'll do a peace sign, and you get this big grin and yay and all of that. And it's like, I don't want a photo of someone being posed. I want you to be natural.
Right.
I've actually seen, there's a few people that have done entire series of photo books that contain photographs of couples in like Shibuya, Shinjuku and all of that, and they're just standing there with this horrible pose, and the guy's has made books out of this.
Wow.
And it just doesn't appeal to me.
Yeah.
So here in Japan, there are photographic opportunities, and if you tend to take the time to sort of perfect the art, and you spend the time, obviously, because with me I can speak the language as well.
Right.
So if I was to spend the time and say, okay, so I want to take this photograph, can you give me a few minutes, and then ask them not to give you the peace sign, do all of that, that's something that is definitely possible. And this is why I'm not ruling out street photography at all, because at the moment, I'm really just prioritizing the time that I have for photography. I'm prioritizing it to do the thing that I love, which is nature and wildlife photography.
Right.
As I am able to sort of free up time for other types of photography, I'll definitely try to do that sort of thing. But it's just that at the moment, if I don't have the time to really work a subject and do it properly the way I want to, then I'm just not going to do it at the moment.
Right.
But it's definitely okay.
And it's different strokes for different folks. I think you hit me on the head. If that's your deal, where you like going out and getting people to pose out in public and catch them in that kind of environment, then there's absolutely nothing wrong with that.
Mm.
It just depends on what, I guess, for lack of a better phrase, what your shtick is.
Right.
You know,
right.
If that's what you seek out, then by all means, you can do that anywhere, whether you're in Japan, whether you're in England or the United States or wherever you are. You know, you just got to find whatever area of photography interests you the most. So, that's cool stuff.
Yeah.
And you mentioned, you said your main area of interest is nature and wildlife.
Right, right.
So what kind of stuff do you do there? Because you had mentioned off the air that you did winter wildlife somewhere. You did that every year. Where was that?
Hokkaido. There's a number of places. There's two. This is probably going to turn into a plug for my workshops, but I run nature and wildlife workshops, and from last year we've been visiting a place in Honshu, you know, the main island of Japan as well, called Nagano. And you may have seen, I believe they were even used on some commercials over there during the Winter Olympics. There's these monkeys that they're snow monkeys, they're macaques. But these monkeys that sit in hot spring baths and pools, and so they're like hot tubbers, and you get a whole group of them in this pool. So from last year,
they're hot tubbing in a pool. These monkeys,
right? I mean, I've got photographs of like four or five of them in a row with their arms over the edge of the pool, and they look like it's like, you know, you can almost name them. You know, one's probably Margaret, and the next one's Gloria, and they're all sort of, you know, they're all sitting there in their hot tub having a really nice time. But they are beautiful shots as well, and if you can catch them when it's snowing, then you get the snow on the fur, and they're just such an amazing. What people should do, I mean, I don't think you include photographs in the show notes and things, but what people should do to take a look, and this will also give you an idea of the workshops that I do as well. If you go to mbpworkshops.com, that's Martin Bailey Photography's mbpworkshops.com, on the right side there, there's a number of galleries that they're just simple galleries to give people an idea of the sort of photographs that we shoot on the workshops. But on the right side there, there's one for monkeys, which you can see. I know I shouldn't be saying this myself, but it's got some really nice shots in there of the macaques.
Well, that's a good thing. I think that's also leads to an important point, is that if you do good work, be proud of it, you know, and say, hey. So by all means, definitely check out. Was it mbpworkshops.com? And actually, I hadn't told Martin about this, so I'll kind of let him know as well. For those of you that are listening to the podcast via iTunes, so if you download it from iTunes, you will see these pictures now, because I am doing the M4A format where you can see the pictures that we're talking about.
Oh, brilliant. So, in that case, I'll provide you with a few of them and stick them in there.
I was going to mention that to you off the air, and completely slipped my mind until you started talking about it. I was like, oh.
No problem.
I told Martin about that.
So the thing is, what we do, that is a 3-day tour at the beginning of the tour, and then after that we jump on a plane. We actually go over there on a bus, and then we drive over to an airport near Tokyo, and then we jump on a plane and go to Hokkaido, which is the northernmost island of Japan. I call it a winter wonderland. We spend nine full days there on the long tour.
Wow.
And basically, we start off shooting the red crown cranes, the beautiful, you know, the very majestic, huge birds. We spend 2 days shooting those. If the weather conditions are right, it's got to be like minus, the temperature has to be lower than minus 15 Celsius in the morning to get this, and there has to be no wind. But when you get the conditions right, you get this beautiful frost on the trees and mist on the river. And so, the cranes are down there. That's one of the highlights of the first few days. And then we move on to, we go over to a place called Kusharo, which is a small, it's actually pretty big, like a lake that freezes most of the time. And you have swans over there, hooper swans. And then we go over to the Shirataka Peninsula, which is a UNESCO registered natural heritage site. And that's basically where we have Stella seagulls, white-tailed eagles. And we just basically spend 9 days going around area.
That's an amazing workshop. 9 days long. Is this? You said this is in the winter. What's the winter? I don't know when winter is in Japan. Pardon my ignorance.
So, Well, we're Northern Hemisphere, so it's the same. We get pretty much the same seasons as you do over in the States.
So you're talking January, February, somewhere in there?
Yeah. So from, like, last year, we only did the one tour, but because I sold it out and I had about nine people on a cancellation list, I'm actually doing two tours in 2011.
Check this out. Martin Bailey's doing tours for 2011. When are these going to take place?
So the first one is a five-day tour, and we don't put the snow monkeys on the first one. It's just a Hokkaido five-day whirlwind tour. And this is really for people that either live in Japan or they're here on business and they don't have a lot of time. But we go from February 17th to the 11th in 2011. And then the following week, from February 13th to the 24th, we start the Snow Monkeys tour for 3 days, and then we head up to Hokkaido for 9 days.
Oh, so you got a 12-day workshop going on too then.
Right. Well, that's like the 9 day that I just mentioned. That's just the Hokkaido section.
Oh, gotcha. So we
link that with 3 days shooting the snow monkeys.
Gotcha.
So okay. In total, it's a 9 day tour.
So it's like two workshops in one. Then, if you do the longer one, you get in two different workshops.
Right. Exactly. Cool. I used to do it until last year. I used to do it when you had optional phases, when you could just go for the wildlife, you could just go for the monkeys, or you could just go for the landscape section. But we've actually, you know, the landscape section, although the landscape in Hokkaido is beautiful, it takes a long time to get over there. And when weather conditions are bad, it's actually, you're spending almost a full day on the bus, and people just didn't really think it was worth it. So I've cut that out, and we're now going to spend more time. Most of the time, we spend two or four nights in each hotel now. Right. And so it's the same length, but we're just concentrating on the wildlife, and we'll have 1 day, actually 2 days, where we're doing some landscape work. But we're not going to do a landscape section as I have done for the last 3 years. But it's really great. I mean, we're looking forward to it. Everybody that comes always has been lots of great feedback.
And what kind of people do you see coming to these workshops? Do you see people coming from primarily the local area? Like you said, people in business, people that are visiting. Or do you see people signing up from, like, England or the U.S. or Australia or other places and coming in?
Mostly from outside. Each year I have a few people that live here that turn up. The people that turn up that are local, I genuinely only want to do a 5 day tour, and that's why I've created two for next year.
That makes sense. And you said first one was the 7th to the 11th of February, so that's Monday through Friday. It's a Monday through Friday, so it's a full week long. And then the
13th through, what was the other day? The 13th to the 24th is a Sunday to, I think it's Thursday or Friday. Let me just check the website.
Yeah, that's a Thursday, that's a Sunday, February 13th through Thursday, February 24th of 2011 is his longer workshop. Well, very cool. And it's funny because that's something people would ask me about, is whether or not I was going to do some workshops. And I've been leaning away from it, but after hearing about yours, we may have to do something here. I don't know. I may want to come to one of yours first. I don't. I may try to get over there. I don't know.
No, it would be great if we could see you over here. But you know, in answer to the second part of your question, you're asking. You know, most of the people that do turn up, especially for the longer tour, are from the States and Australia, and we've had people from Sweden, Norway, England. France last year. We have people from Belgium as well, and we've had people from all over the world. So it's a great week. You know, you get to meet a lot of people. A number of people have been back, you know, more than once.
That's awesome.
I've got one guy from Australia, an amazing photographer, named Graham Morgan. He is coming for his third time next year.
Wow.
He didn't come this year, and he said his summer just wasn't the same. He missed us. So he's signed up for next year as well. Yeah, it's amazing. It's great. I mean, I shouldn't say myself, but it really is a good tour. So if anyone's interested, let me know. Well, you can actually, if you are interested, now we've come this far, it's just turned into one big plug.
But, don't worry about it. I'm sitting on the edge of my seat for those of you that, well, I know no one can see me, but I'm like leaning in, like I'm wanting to hear more about this, so it's very, very cool to hear about. Well, moving on,
I was just going to say, you know, you can actually, if you don't want to go, if you want to just blast an email, you can shoot that off to workshops@martinbaileyphotography.com as well, and I'll give you any information you need.
Okay. And we'll post all these links up in the show notes as well, people. So if you're in the middle of your daily workout or driving your car or trying to commute in, don't stop to write this down. We'll put all the links up. No sense getting in an accident or getting a link down. I'll put everything up there as well. The last thing I wanted to talk to you about that was more about your background was, because you said you've been there for 20 years. How long have you been doing these workshops now?
The workshops, next year will be my fourth year.
Okay. So what started all that? You said you got into, did I even ask you? What started you into photography? What got you interested? Let's go back to the beginning. What got you into photography?
When I was a kid, the first thing the first real photography exposure that I got was through my friend's dad. My dad bought a Polaroid, and when he realized that the film was expensive, I think he sold it. But my friend's dad was a photographer. I think he had a Zenith and an old Russian camera. And I loved just the whole thing about that, And every so often he'd let me sort of shoot the odd image. And I went on holiday with those guys. And it was just really nice to play around with the equipment.
Yeah.
But then when I was 14, I bought myself one of those old 110 cameras. I think they were 11mm negatives.
That was my first camera as well. I had a Vivitar 110.
Yeah, and they were good for what they were. I mean, I didn't realize at the time people were only interested in getting a 5x7 or small prints. So it wasn't such a big thing. But that got me sort of interested in the actual act of doing photography. But then. In my late teens, early 20s, I started sort of hiking in the UK, and I would take a plastic disposable camera it wasn't disposable, it was a plastic camera, but it took 35mm film.
Nice.
I was getting some nice photos back from there, and people started saying that they were nice, so cool. Obviously, they get a bit of praise, it starts to...
Just kind of grew from there then, didn't it?
Right.
That's awesome.
I mean, the biggest change, though, was coming to Japan. When I came to Japan in 1991... I bought my first SLR, and I just from that point on I've really started to get into. My brother bought me a book on photography for a birthday after I got to Japan, and he really sort of with that encouraged me to sort of learn the technical side and the artistic side. But it all went from there, just being in Japan and having such a totally different culture to work on.
So what took you over to Japan initially if it wasn't photography? Or was it photography?
It wasn't. This is the strange thing, and people often don't get this, but I was raised in a small town called Long Eaton, very close to, between Nottingham and Derby, the cities of Nottingham and Derby in England. And the trade in that town was Nottingham lace or Hoover's lace. And this is basically a woven lace, but it's the sort of stuff that you use on underwear or like tablecloths and things like that. And that was my trade. And after high school, I didn't go to university. My parents had been divorced before I left high school, so didn't have the luxury of going to university. And to be honest, leaving high school in 1983 in Thatcher's Britain, there wasn't much point in going to university anyway, because there were no jobs. people were basically trying to make a living with what they could. So I was lucky enough to get into a trade, and it was relatively well paid. And then, after I'd been doing that for a number of years, I walked into we call it a canteen, the place where we had the coffee machine and that at the office.
Right.
A factory. And the canteen lady turned to me and said, "You've seen this?" And there was the local newspaper with a big advertisement for working in Japan.
Right.
And I thought, okay, well, I wanted to learn a language. I got fed up of not using my ring, so I was starting to look into learning a language. I was going to go to night school to learn German, but I thought, ooh, Japanese, now that sounds cool.
That sounds intriguing, yeah.
Right.
So how close is Japanese to Chinese? Could you...
You can read some, obviously, a lot of Westerners don't bother to learn to read it, right? Japanese. So I did after the first year, I decided it was important. So you can read and understand the language, but the pronunciation is very different.
Sure, yeah. I can actually hear the difference when I hear someone I shouldn't say Japanese accent, but what I can hear a distinct difference between the two sounds. I guess the languages sound different, but I know that they're both Asian-based, so, you know.
Right. There
might be some transition there. So tell you, so you got into photography, starting with the 110, and you actually are now, you're a Canon shooter, correct?
Right, yeah.
And because you mentioned the, what do you shoot with? 1D Mark II?
I've got three cameras. I've got the 1DS Mark IV, and then I've got, the next one I bought was the 5D Mark II, basically for the video and as a second camera. When I got the 21 megapixel 1DS Mark IV and I started to see how much more beautiful the large prints were, I was using my old 5D as a second camera, especially with wildlife. You need a second camera with a different, you know, a zoom lens or something for
wild things.
And I just wasn't reaching for the 5D because it was so, you know, it was like half the resolution.
Right.
And so Canon had brought out the 5D Mark II. It was a third of the price and it was the same resolution. So I figured that I'd go for that. And then, of course, for wildlife, when the 1D Mark IV came out with its, you know, obviously it's got 10 frames per second.
Right.
And it's relatively high resolution. Certainly enough for a reasonably large print. So I decided that I was going to go for that as well. So at the moment, I've got three cameras.
Excellent.
I'll probably be selling the 1DS Mark III and the 5D II in the coming months to put money towards the 1DS Mark IV, which has just been leaked.
Right. So, I didn't catch that news yet.
The Canon Rumors website has got information on it. They're not committing to it because they don't want to get burned, but apparently 32 megapixels and
They're in my feeder. I guess I haven't hit it in a couple of days. Canon Rumors did a thing on it. I'll have to go check it out now.
So that's it. That's what I'm using. And I think I've got like pretty much every lens that I need. There's a few more than I'd like, but I don't like to add stuff just for the sake of it.
That's a good point, because a lot of people ask me that kind of thing too. They're like, well, what kind of camera should I get? You know, then I think one of the listener questions this week speaks to that subject as well. What camera should I get? What lens should I get? What flash should I get? You can really go hog wild with gear. You can have one camera, you can have three cameras, you can have 10 cameras. And I think Chase Jarvis said something like this. It really doesn't matter how many cameras you have. What matters is the camera that you have with you.
Yeah. Well, that's very true. I am the sort of person that I put it, although I don't go over the top on, you know.
If you had to pick your favorite, though, which one would it be? If you had to pick your favorite camera of all of your three that you own, which one would you say is your most
Probably the 1DS Mark IV in a few months. out of the cameras that I've got right now, the best camera of the three for really, you know, for the camera itself is certainly the 1DS Mark IV, and that's why it's so expensive. But, I mean, it's you can beat nails in with that thing if you want to. It's just so tough.
Yeah.
And when you're working in, like, down to minus 25, minus 30 degrees in Hokkaido, and you're photographing and driving snow or rain.
Is it really that cold there?
In the mornings, yeah.
That's insanely cold.
It is.
Holy cow.
We had one morning in February this year, where it was minus 30. We had a snow pillar, which is like it's so cold that the water particles in the air freeze and form a pillar that sort of reflect the light from the sun. It was beautiful.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
I don't know about the cold aspect of it, but
because I was actually I was there, and there was a number of the older participants had gone back to the bus. They'd got their shots and they'd gone back to the bus. But I turned to the group, and I get really excited in the cold. It just doesn't really affect me as much as some people. And I was there, this big grin on my face. I was singing and smiling, and I turned to the group and I said, "You know, it doesn't feel that cold." And they all just stared back at me with this really strange grin.
Are you kidding me? That's funny.
They were very. They didn't quite see it.
Yeah. I think that goes to, like you said, you know, you just, some people more acclimate easier to different temperatures than others do. Because I remember when I was in South Carolina, it was just, it was ungodly hot all the time. When I lived in South Carolina, it would get down to the 60s in the wintertime. And 60 degrees would be a freezing cold day. And when I was living in South Carolina, at 60 degree weather, I would put a sweatshirt on. and right now, it's like 70 degrees out, and it's, what time are we at here? Oh my gosh, it's almost 10 o'clock here. It's 9:30 here in Colorado right now. And it's 70 degrees, and I am stinking hot. I'm just like, oh my God. So I think it's a matter of acclimation. That's a different climate.
Well, Tokyo's very temperate. Tokyo itself, it's very hot in the summers. We can get up to like 38, 40 degrees Celsius in the summers.
Wow.
I'm not good at converting to Fahrenheit, but in the winter, it doesn't go below freezing very often in Tokyo. But the thing is with me, and I think it's because of something called the hunter's response, and that's like, I don't know, it's something from the Inuit genes, maybe I've got some, Northern European genes in me somewhere. But apparently when you, they call it the hunter's response because people, Norway, Inuits, various people, like Eskimos and those sort of people, when they're hunting, you have to maintain dexterity in your fingers. And so what happens is normally, when you get really cold, your body stops sending blood to your extremities to keep you warm.
Right.
But if your life depends on being able to pull a trigger or pull a bow or fish, then you need to stay to your fingers. And so what I find is that when I'm just standing around, I'm as cold as the next guy.
Yeah.
But the moment I start shitting, which you could think of as being hunting, because I'm like hunting for my images.
Right.
The moment I start shooting, my fingers get toasty. And so I'm at the top of these mountains, and people will say, why aren't you wearing a glove? And I do when it gets very cold, and sometimes I need them, but I can not be wearing gloves, and I'll say, take your balaclava off or something, and I'll touch the guy's cheek, and my hands without gloves are warmer than his cheek, and he's all wrapped up.
Wow.
I'm pretty sure it's down to this hunter's response, so I'm lucky in that respect.
Well, for those of you that want to know what the conversion is, 40 degrees Celsius is 104 degrees Fahrenheit.
Right, right.
And when you say it gets down to minus 20?
Yeah, minus 25. It was minus 30 one morning this year.
Minus 30 in Celsius is about 20 below zero Fahrenheit. So it's pretty cold. I think by anyone's standards,
That's cold. I mean,
cold.
It's not like that. So just in case I'm starting to put people off, something. It happens, we've not had minus 30 except for this one time. Last year we had a minus 25. Usually it's below freezing in the mornings, but actually during the day, when we're doing the majority of our stamina around shooting cranes, or we go out on a boat shooting the eagles, at those times it's usually around freezing point. So and with the right clothing, you just don't feel it that much. So
that brings up another great point about photography, planning for a photo shoot. Look at the weather, that's an important aspect, and dress accordingly. We did a shoot up in Rocky Mountain National Park in the winter, and it was pretty cold out. It was probably in the teens, and we had a pretty significant wind chill, but because we knew what the weather was going to be like, we had bundled up, we'd gotten all the appropriate gear for the climate and the clothing for the climate together to where we were actually pretty comfortable. Well, most of us were. One guy went out in tennis shoes. I don't know why, but if you dress for the climate, you can actually be very comfortable regardless of where you are.
Right. During the day, I often end up taking my jacket off, and I'm just walking around in a pile of fleece and the underwear. So it's not as though it's really that cold all the time.
God bless thermals. I don't know what I'd do without my thermals. Well, great. That's really great. Thanks for stopping in. I did have one last question I wanted to ask you, because I know from a pure cultural perspective, shooting photography in Japan is very different from shooting photography in the States, because there's such a different variety of things to look at. And I know, for example, like when I go out shooting, I'll look at some people's work in, say, an architectural vein. So I'll look at architectural photographers, or I'll look at Cartier-Bresson from France for street types of photography. So living in Japan and capturing the images over there, do you have any... like sources of inspiration that you move towards, like, okay, I'm going to be going to shoot these monkeys. You know, what are your sources of inspiration that you reference in developing your own branding and your own style of photography? So that's something a lot of people ask. Yeah. Well, how do you develop your style? It's like, well, you really draw inspiration from different sources depending on what interests you. So for your nature and wildlife in Japan, where do you draw your inspiration from?
Well, I was lucky enough a few years ago to... The first time that I went to Hokkaido in the winter was on a workshop with a professional photographer over here called Yoshiaki Kobayashi. And when
You're
I got
have
there...
You're going to spell that for me after the show.
when I got there, I didn't know this at the time, but he was joined by another photographer called Hiroshi Yokoyama. And Yokoyama-sensei, as I call him. And, you know, we traveled together for a week. And I actually met him a number of times after this, but he was, as a person, he was just such an amazing sort of tender and yet funny person. And, I mean, he's in his 70s now, I believe, maybe early 70s. He used to be a professional winter sports photographer in his heyday. But a number of years ago, probably about 20 years ago now, he moved to Hokkaido. And he started to photograph the wildlife in one of the main areas that I visit. And his work just has a sensitivity that I love. It's not always like top action shots, but he'll capture like a fox. And in the summertime, he'll capture a fox playing around in a field of flowers. Or he'll capture the cranes in the early morning with the mist coming out of their mouths. And eagles in a tree with the sun, a huge sun disk behind them and things like that. So I definitely was inspired and probably affected to a large degree by Hiroshi Yokoyama. There's also, you know, like I say, I mean, Yoshiaki Kobayashi, he does some great work, but I think the main thing from that trip was from Yokoyama Sensei. And then there's, I guess, in Japan as well, there's another guy named Mike, I forget, he's a younger guy, he's about two years younger than me. And he goes to Alaska and you know, various places, and he has some amazing photography as well.
I didn't catch the other name.
Maekawa. I forget his first name. His second name is Maekawa, Maekawa. That guy's done some really nice work as well. I met him. I shouldn't talk about Alaska and Japanese photographies without also mentioning what's his name? Michio something. I forget the guy's name. And there's Hoshino. Hoshino, his surname's Hoshino. First name's Michio, I think. He was eaten by a bear. He died a few years ago.
Oh, no.
And he was eaten by a bear in Alaska. But his work was pretty amazing as well.
Is there anyone from the western side that you also drew inspiration from, or has it primarily been from the
Asians? To be honest, I mean, although I'm not really that totally affected by any of these people to the extent where I would try to copy their work.
But no, I'm talking in terms of like source of inspiration, like people that, you've admired, you know, you've liked the quality of their work, you've kind of drawn aspects of it into your own work. And these are some great names that I've not even heard of before, and I'm going to have to go Google these after we're done with our podcast. I'm like, wow, this sounds really cool. So
unfortunately, Yokoyama Sensei doesn't have a lot of work online. He does a lot of exhibitions. He doesn't have a lot of work online that you'll find.
Oh, okay.
But Western influences, I love to see Art Wolf's images.
He's a great nature wildlife photographer.
Right. The thing, I really respect his nature and wildlife work, but the thing that I like about Art Wolf is that he also shoots the culture and the people of the places that he goes to. And that's one thing, as I get more time, I manage to put more time to do this, that I really want to aspire to, because I do enjoy meeting people. I like shooting, you know, I like doing portrait work. But at the moment, because I've only got a certain amount of time, I prioritize it on the nature and wildlife. As I get more time, I certainly want to do that. And I love some of the cultural work that Art Wolf does as well.
Yeah, and I think that same tendency would hold true for anyone, because you have your primary genre that you're most interested in or that you spend the most time with, but there's always an interest in other genres as well. Right. So if you're a portrait photographer, you occasionally get the pull of the landscape, or if you're an architectural photographer, you occasionally veer into portraiture, or, you know, do an occasional wedding if someone asks you to. So, you know, there's always side tangential things that I think everyone gets interested in. Like, I've seen some work from, I forget this guy's name. He does a lot of flora, fauna type photography, and I forget his name.
Tony Sweet? So Tony Sweet is another person that I was going to mention especially my early inspiration. He's still going now, of course. He's a great photographer.
So he's a Western one, Tony Sweet.
He lives in the US as well, and he does some really nice flowers and abstract shots, like where he moves the camera around and things. But Tony Sweet's done some very nice flower work, and I like.
He's got a website. He's over at www.tonysweet.com. So he's got a gallery there. He does some workshops. He's got a bio there as well. So you can learn more about Tony Sweet over at his website. Where were we in our show notes? I keep bouncing all over the place. We've been talking for a while. You know what? We are going to take a quick break here because I realize that people like to have quick segues and moments where they can pause the show. So go ahead and do a pause on your podcast or on your iPod or however you're listening to the show. We'll be back in just a minute. We're talking with Martin Bailey. Be back right after this. All right, thanks for coming back. We are back here talking with Martin Bailey on the Learning Digital Photography podcast. You're listening to episode number 26. And we just finished wrapping up on some of the sources of inspiration that Martin had in his development as a photographer. And the last thing I want to talk to him about is something actually he had mentioned to me, because you told me offline that you just joined the X-Rite Colorati. Explain to me what that is, because I've heard of it. I know X-Rite because I've got a great tag with Beth, an X-Rite colorimeter. So I know they do a lot of color management, but I've not heard of the Colorati before. So tell us a little bit about that. What's involved with that? What does that do?
Well, the as a little bit of background, X-Rite. I started to use X-Rite products about 6 months ago when I bought a Color Checker Passport, which is like a little passport-sized, it's a white balance card, a grey card for setting your white balance, but then it has some colour targets in there. You shoot that, and then the software that comes with it, you can make profiles, raw profiles or DNG profiles in Lightroom, so that you get really accurate colour in your images.
Right.
Bought that, fell in love with it, and then the next thing I did I bought their Colour Monkey Photo, which is a monitor calibration tool, but it also will allow you to create print profiles, and you can calibrate overhead projectors and things as well.
With the Color Monkey. Right. I didn't know because I've got the Great Tag Macbeth one, and I think that used to be a different company. The X-Rite bought them out or something like that.
Right.
Or something, and my colorimeter does not do projectors.
Yeah.
Well, so I think that was before they bought
it. It's $300 and something dollars. It's not overly expensive.
It's an I1 Display 2. That's what mine is. It's an I1 Display 2 from Grey Tag Macbeth. And then X-Rite bought out Grey Tag, I think.
Yeah, that seems to be what's happened, because they've got all of these products on their website.
So now X-Rite has a Color Monkey calibrator. Or actually, technically, it's called a colorimeter.
Yeah.
So for those of you that are on the technical side, don't send me emails saying, it's not a calibrator, it's a color. You know, it's a colorimeter. But everyone calls them calibrators or a monitor device.
It's a tool to calibrate your monitor. Yeah. So, you know, that whatever you want to call it.
It's a monitor tool.
So I really started to change my digital workflow and make it totally color managed, from capture right through to print, and also obviously on the monitor.
Right.
So then I was pleasantly surprised to receive a phone call from X-Rite in Japan a few months ago, and they basically asked me to come in and see them, and they offered to enroll me in the Colorati or Colorazzi. Apparently it's like the paparazzi.
What is it that they do? What's the function of the group? Is that a good word, a group? Is it a group of people?
It's a group of people, and I'm pretty honored to be a member. I mean, like we just mentioned Art Wolf, he's a member. Rick Salmon, John Paul Caponegro, Vincent Laffrey. These guys are all members of the Colorati, and so I'm pretty pleased to be in there.
Is there anything about it on their website where people could go and find out? What is it? It's X-Rite Photo. Is there anything about the Colorati? Right.
Yeah, if you go to xritephoto.com, and then there's a tile at the bottom. At the moment, it's the third tile from the left on the bottom there.
And it's Colorati. Is that what it's called?
Right, right.
Is it Colorati or Colorati?
Well, it's a play on the word paparazzi, so it probably is Colorati, but I don't know.
Okay. We'll throw a link up in the show notes. Don't worry, folks. xritephoto.com. Look for something that looks like Colorati or Colorati. You'll find it there on the bottom of the page. It sounds like it's all about color management in the digital workflow, right?
It's C-O-L-O-R-A-T-T-I.
Colorati. Okay, so there's no Z in there. It's more of a T.
Right.
Colorati. And that's over at xrite.com. They got a lot of great products there. Like I said, I have one of the colorimeters before it got bought out, but it still is. And that's a funny thing. I still get support updates from xrite.
Yeah.
You know, so they're sending out updates for this all the time. And it's a fantastic product. I've heard great things about the Color Monkey, too. And they have this group of... So do you do workshops with Colorati? Is that what they do about...
Yeah, well, what they've done is they've... When I went in to visit them, I asked if they would support my workshops aimed at I could, you know, could get some of these color checkers and color monkeys and things, a number of them, so that I could work with a group and, you know, and actually incorporate color management lectures and seminars into my workshops. And they were great. You know, they gave me a number of these things to use, passports and a couple of color monkeys. So now I can work with a relatively large group, and we can share these products, and you know, we're out in the field in Hokkaido, we're able to, you know, I've got Antarctica workshops coming up as well, and these things, you know, we'll take the color checker passports, and we'll get people doing color management in the field.
That's a great way to teach too, is to teach people about the color managed workflow and having them see the products and the difference it can make in your print. That's very valuable. Some other people, I went to the website check it out while you were talking there, and they've got the people you mentioned, but they've also got Andrew Rodney.
Yep.
And for those of you that don't know Andrew Rodney, he's basically a color guru. He's a member of the NAPP, National Association of Photoshop Professionals. I've talked to him. He's guest written over on the blog. They have Eddie Tapp in there. They've got Brian Marcus in there, Andy Marcus in there, like you said, Art Wolf. And now you're there. Wow, that's very cool.
Obviously, I was just naming a few there. Andrew Biggs is a member.
Andrew Biggs is there.
There's a whole bunch of great photographers. I'm just very, very humbled and honored to be a member of the group.
That's very cool. I'd say and speaking of a color management workflow, I'm actually very excited about the color management workflow system that I am now getting set up, because not only am I doing the color management workflow from start to finish through the monitor and the print and establishing the profiles, the monitor profile, the paper profile, but because we just moved into this house, one thing I did, Tracy, my wife, gave me free reign in this room, I painted it neutral gray. I've got an entire room that's neutral gray, and our window is covered with black felt, so it really is a completely color managed workflow, and I've got daylight balance bulbs in here.
Nice.
So anything that comes out of this room is as perfect a color managed workflow as you can get. And while I've not done any prints yet, I'm very excited to see the prints that come out, because when you work in a color managed workflow, the output that you get, and this is why it's always so important, because people say, well, why is that important or relevant for photography? And the answer is, in photography, a color managed workflow is important because what you see on the monitor is what you want to see on the print. And if you don't have a color managed workflow, there's going to be discrepancies there as you move through the process, because different things will have a different impact, whether it's your monitor driver, whether it's the type of paper that you're using, or the type of printer that you're using, or the type of light that you're looking at it under, which is why it's always so challenging to look at photos on the web, because most browsers aren't color aware.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's
always going to be a little bit of discrepancy in print, because as you mentioned, it depends on the paper and everything, but the limitations of the printer as well.
That's right, the printer as well.
I use the 9500 from Canon, and even that, even though it's got 10 color, you know, it's got 10 ink cartridges.
Yeah.
There is a little bit of discrepancy, but you know,
but you can get it real close, I bet. that's a nice printer.
I shoot a lot of very vibrant. I mean, I either go black and white or I go very vibrant. Right. And some of my what I call flowerscapes, where they've got like huge swaths of red across, you know, loads of beautiful bokeh, pronounced bokeh, by the way, not bokeh or bouquet.
You're going to get some emails on this, because I've heard people say both. And
I did a podcast on that.
I stay at it. Oh, that's right. That's where I remembered hearing about it. Yeah.
So the thing is that you do still have to do soft proofing. If you're using a set of colors that your printer doesn't really want to print, but you can also enhance or increase the accuracy of the profiles that you can produce with the Color Monkey by showing it a picture, and then it takes a sample of the various tones and colors within that picture, and it creates another target that you can then read in. You can continue to enhance and increase the accuracy of the profiles that you make with the Color Monkey.
Does that mean there's a spectrophotometer or something like that? Because that's what scans paper, right?
Well, yeah, the thing is, the Color Monkey has that built in.
That's the same thing.
Right.
That's very cool.
It's very cool. It's all built in.
That is sweet. For those of you that aren't familiar, it used to be there would be separate devices where you could calibrate a display or a projector or anything that projected an image with a colorimeter, and then you had to have a different device that would calibrate paper. So what you would do is you'd get a color, like a color test chart, and you would print that out, and then you would place a spectrophotometer, I think is what it's called. You would place a different device called a spectrophotometer on top of the paper. It would scan that and look for the color densities and the sharpness and the thickness and the vibrance and all that kind of stuff, and it would produce a paper profile for that paper. So you used to have, if you really wanted to have a completely accurate color workflow, you would need to have a colorimeter and a spectrophotometer. And these aren't cheap devices by any means. I mean, you can get cheaper ones or more economical ones, but to have both of these as part of your workflow used to be quite challenging, because it'd be a big-time investment. So what Martin's saying here, the reason why this is really key, is because both of these things are now incorporated into one device. Right. So you get a colorimeter and a spectrophotometer all the same device. So that's very cool.
You turn it around so that it uses various functions, and it can also read the ambient light in the room, as well as, like we say, it can do.
My iOne Display 2 does that. It does the ambient light, but does not do the spectrophotography or this. I forget. Am I saying that right? Is it a spectrophotometer? Is that right?
I don't know.
It's something, it's some kind of spectrum.
It's an ambient light meter.
Yeah, there you go. It's a paper light meter, sure, why not? That's awesome. Yeah, so this is some great stuff. So go check out the Colorati. It'll give you a lot more information on what a color management workflow is all about, all that's involved. You can see some of the names that are in there. And now Martin Bailey is also a member as well, so congratulations on that. That's awesome. We had a couple of listener questions that did come up on the show, and I know the show's going kind of long here. So we'll get to these listener questions. We had three that came in. I saw a couple come in through Twitter that Martin had put up, and one that came in through email. How do you want to do these? Do you want to just take them 1, 2, 3?
Sure.
Okay. The first one comes into us from George in Kansas. George writes in to ask, I've seen a lot of new services popping up where people will offer professional critique of your portfolio for a fee. How can I tell which ones are legit, and what should I expect from these professional critiques? He doesn't want to pay for... Basically, he said, I'll just read this word for it. He said, I don't want to pay money for someone just to tell me, nice shot. I can get that... He was kind of funny. I can get that online for free. And that's actually kind of true, because you do see that in photography forums and communities sometimes.
Yeah. Well, Flickr is generally a positive feedback site. Yeah, people, if people don't have positive feedback, they don't comment.
Yeah, And that's usually the indication of the quality of the shot. If you don't see any comments, it's because the shot sucks.
It's a bit of both, I think. The other thing with Flickr is, I mean, I don't get that many comments. Basically, obviously, my photos could suck, but it's also, I don't comment a lot on other people's photos. I think that Flickr, the more you comment, the more comments you get. Right. So
it's very much a participatory type of thing.
Right.
It's definitely leans towards that end, that's for sure. This is actually a great question, and I'd seen it a couple times before. I used to be a kind of a leader of a photo group in South Carolina called South Carolina Photography Guild, or SC Photogs, and I put together a little paper back then for them so they could see the different types of critiques that are out there, because some people were complaining and saying, hey, you know, can we not be so mean about this? I'm like, well, there's different types of critiques. It depends on what kind of critique you want. So to kind of answer the question for this show, I'm actually going to refer you to that paper. And I wrote it, so I think it's a really good paper. But I'll put a link up in the show notes to the South Carolina Photography Guild's resource page, because it's still up on there. And the title of the paper is, if I can find it right off the top of my head, which obviously I can't, because I'm not prepared. This is what happens when you're not prepared for your podcasts. But it's called something like critique or different types of critiques or something like that. I'll put a link up in the show notes. Yeah, I'll stick it in the show notes. But there's several different kinds of critiques, or image review is what I would like to call it. And there it is. That's what the link is called. It's Image Review Guidelines from the South Carolina Photography Guild. And basically, there's three or four different types. And the first type is that where you see on these community boards, nice shot, or they don't say anything at all. And then there's professional critiques, where you can actually pay someone to actually professionally critique your portfolio. And at that point, they're not, at least I don't think, they're telling you what's wrong with your pictures, per se. Whereas they will give you tips for improvement, like you might want to consider this type of display setup or this kind of background setting, you know, how you're framing your work, how you're presenting your work, that kind of thing would be more along the lines of what you would be looking at in a professional review. Mm-hmm. And so there's a professional review, and then there's a casual review, and then I would also include in that a peer review, where you basically are having friends look at your pictures, and that can be a little more valuable than someone that just comes along and says, nice shot, and it might not be as valuable as a professional review, but it's not a professional review because, you know, they're going to be biased. They're your friends. They're your peers. Mm. So, you know, it's good to get for the objective analysis and feedback on what's good, including, you know, there may be times where there are areas that could use improvement. And I would say it probably takes a tougher skin to accept reviews of this nature because you may get feedback that points out flaws. So if you're looking for a peer review, you know, just be forewarned. You're going to get a little more, I guess, honest review or honest feedback on your photos, and you know that there's a set of expectations involved there. And then there's a juried review, and those are usually the ones that I think are associated with like contests and shows and things like that. So if you're going to pay to have someone review your photos, that would be the type of review that I would think would be involved. And that, like I said, would usually come, at least from my experience, would come from juried shows, things of that nature, where you would have someone who is telling you, you know, the kinds of things that you should be thinking about when it comes to displaying your work in a gallery environment. You know, it's more from other professionals where they're telling you, you know, these are the kinds of lighting things you want to consider when lighting your photos. These is what color you should paint the wall. Here's the sequence that you should order them in. It's much, you know, really dials into all the different details, not just of the photography itself, but how to display it, how to show it, the order to show it, and all stuff like that. There are different kinds of costs associated with those from my experience, and it really will vary depending on where you are and who you're asking for the critique. So that's the nuts and bolts of the different kinds of critiques that I've heard about. I don't know, Martin, if you want to chime in on different kinds of critiques and reviews that you've seen that you would be willing to share. Like, do you do portfolio reviews during your workshops for people?
We're starting to do that next year. We haven't had the time to do that so far. But next year, that's one of the things that I've built in.
So how would you classify that? I guess I kind of talked a little bit long there on the different types of reviews that I've seen. Would you?
I'm calling them a critique session, just okay. because we're gonna, yeah, I'm gonna take an overhead projector with me, and okay. Everyone will be given a USB memory key and be asked to put a few images on it,
okay.
and then we'll put them up on the projector, which will be calibrated. and we'll talk about them. Cool. Basically, try and find some good points, try and find some possible areas of improvement, and just try and have a sort of a professional and civil conversation about the pluses and minuses, or the merits and demerits of everybody's images.
Right.
And that will include mine as well, of course. I mean, I don't get to shoot quite as much as I'd like to on these things, obviously, but. Right. I do shoot enough to be able to show people how I've depicted a scene or thought of a particular subject. So
are you letting the participants review your images as well?
That's the objective. That's one of the things that I want to do.
Wow, yeah. that's pretty. I don't know if I can do that.
But I mean, one thing that I did want to say here is, no matter what you do, I think that with critique, if you're going to pay. I would try to find critiques with a photographer that you know and respect.
Yes.
Because if you just pay to get a critique from a review from someone that you don't know, mm-hmm. if you receive negative feedback, you're going to just fob it off, and it's good. It's not really going to be that valuable. I would.
Exactly. I would totally agree with that. Like if I went down the street and I went to someone, Joe Schmo's art studio, photography studio, and asked for a review, and I didn't like it, I probably wouldn't have much impact if I were to get a portfolio review from, say, Joe McNally, or
right.
Moose Peterson, or
right.
Martin Bailey, or some of the more respected names in the community. And yes, that was kind of a joke, but I think made a good point though, because the source of the review is really what matters. And
right.
If you're getting Art Wolf or Rick Salmon or Joe McNally or Moose Peterson, or one of these really well recognized names that's doing a portfolio review for you, it's going to have more of an impact. It has to have
right.
more of an impact that way than someone that you're picking out of a phone book.
Right.
So,
I mean, the thing to note as well is that everybody's different, and even if someone of that caliber said to me, this is crap, get another job, then I don't agree with them, then I would move on. I would just, it has to click. But I think you've got a much better chance of clicking if it comes from someone that you respect, that you know and respect. So,
right. And I guess in that vein, I would also say be leery of just going and picking someone at random from the Yellow Pages or an online service or whatever. Like George said, a new service popping up where they offer to give
right.
a professional critique for a fee. If it's not someone you know of or you've heard of, I wouldn't waste my money on that. And they may be able to, I'm not saying they couldn't give a valuable professional critique, because maybe they could, I don't know. But Martin makes a very good point. If it's not coming from a source that you respect,
yeah.
it's not going to have much of an impact, and I wouldn't pay for that.
Yeah. It could.
So,
I mean, it certainly could.
If
they said something that really, you think, oh, well, okay, that's so obvious. If it really clicks, it could have an impact. But
sure.
I think you've got a better, if you're worried about spending the money on this, a good thing to bear in mind is that it's going to click better if it comes from someone you respect.
Right. I think that's the upshot of that is find someone you recognize and you respect or you admire or is a source of inspiration for you, like we talked about earlier. So the source, I think, is the key aspect here. So consider the source. Great. Well, our second question comes to us from Sean Breslin. This came off of Twitter. Martin, you added this one. Do you know where Sean was from?
Sean is a British guy, lives in Japan. He's been here for like 10 years or so.
Oh, okay. Go ahead with the question. Why don't you just go ahead and run with this one then?
I will, yeah. So he says, how much does it realistically cost to print a photograph, e.g. A4 size, on an Epson printer at home? So A4 or later. I sell prints, and I sell folios of prints, so I've done a little bit of work on this to figure out how much to charge. But it depends totally on what paper you have. The amount of print will vary as well. The amount of ink will vary as well.
Mm-hmm.
But if you use like standard Canon, like their gloss or their silky sort of paper, their satin papers.
Satin, yeah.
Yeah, it will usually cost around $2.50 or about 250 yen for Sean. But that's including relatively cheap stock paper and the ink. I say that the ink cost for that, with the price of inks in Japan, it's about 176 yen, which is about $1.70. But then, if you go to A3, then you're doing basically double that. So you can pretty much figure it out from that. But then, if you want to go for some higher quality paper, you know, the Canon papers are okay, but I mean, I generally do all of my fine artwork on Harman Müller paper, a German company, and the Harman Müller stuff is just it's just amazing. The thing is, it's most of them are matte papers, so it sucks up more ink. Right. And the paper itself, for an A3, for a slice, and for a piece of A3 or A3 plus the 13x19 inch Harman Müller Museum Etching or photo rag paper,
right,
you're talking $5 a sheet.
Yeah.
So, you know, and then you've got probably another $3 worth of ink on top of that.
Right.
So it really depends, and you have to sort of track it a little bit yourself to get a good idea.
You do. You absolutely do. I would totally agree with that. Yeah. For those of you that don't know the yen conversion ratio, I just pulled it up during this because I realized some of the listeners in the States probably don't know what a yen equates to. Roughly, on average, 100 yen will be about $1. So 270 yen will be about $3.
Yeah, it varies.
It does. Your buyers may vary depending on the day, but
yeah,
that's
what I generally use.
So if you're trying to equate the yen, like he was saying, 270 or 150, depending on the paper, you're talking about $1.50 to $3 to upwards of $5 for U.S. dollar conversion rates when it comes to different papers. And you actually brought up a good point about the different types of papers as well, because I've got a couple of Hannah Mule papers. I've got some Red River paper, and I've got some Epson paper that I use with my Epson printer. And all three really produce fantastic quality images. I'm not trying to promote one paper over the other. But the thing is that's unique about papers is papers will have different absorption rates depending on the fibers that they're made up of. And they'll also have different absorption rates based on the type of paper. So you can have like a matte paper and then a luster paper and then a sheen and then a glossy, a semi-gloss, and just all these different types. And they even have metallic papers out now where you can actually get metallic-type paper. I think Red River is making one called a pearl metallic paper. You can put in your inkjet printer and get metallic print, metallic quality prints, but they take up a lot of ink. So, you know, it's going to, you know, the cost per print, like you said, will vary by the paper and the amount of ink that you put on.
Actually, Sean said on an Epson printer, but I've used an Epson printer until I bought the Canon 9500, and I generally find them to be about the same.
Is it? Okay, that's good to know.
So, yeah, it's you know, they don't really use this any more or less. Obviously, the number of cartridges varies, and if they're $10 a cartridge and you've got 10 instead of 6, then it's going to cost more, but
you're generally
laying down about the same amount of ink, so I would imagine it's not too...
It's probably proportional regardless of how many cartridges you have. Well, that's a great question. Thank you to Sean. You said he sent that via Twitter.
We had another one from Amanda Star, or Amanda Star, from Bellevue in Nebraska. So thanks to Amanda Star for there as well. And thanks to Sean for me.
Yes, thank you to Sean.
So, there was another one. Basically, Amanda Star had asked, let's see, what's a good camera for a photographer who's just starting out? And then a follow-up with, I asked what type of photography. And they said more outdoor nature type and animals.
Excellent question. This is a great question. This is one I get a lot via email, too. So,
Do you want to take a plug at it first, or should I?
Sure. I can. See, that's the thing. To be completely honest, when it comes to a good starting out camera, from my perspective, pretty much any camera, and I should qualify this, any SLR camera that you get these days, regardless of whether you want to shoot Canon or Nikon, Pentax, Sony, Samsung, whoever, the quality of cameras these days is better than anything we've ever seen before.
you're going to get, well, I shouldn't say you're going to, but their capabilities are higher than anything we've ever seen before. And if you learn the nuances of cameras with regard to the relationship between shutter and aperture and ISO and the exposure triangle, and you learn the nuts and bolts and you get the sundry stuff down, any camera out there on the market today, I think, will produce a good quality set of prints that will make you happy. Having said that, because I am the author of Canon Blogger, and I own Canon gear, and Martin owns Canon gear, so he'll probably agree with me here, but I would say that I like the way Canon bodies produce their images. I like the Canon formula. For me, that just, it works for me. It's what I like. Different people will have different preferences, of course. Some people like Nikon better. For me, it's not really about the gear, though. It's more about the quality of the shot. So to answer your question, you can get pretty much any kind of shot you want from any camera you want. It's really going to come down to personal preference on what a good camera is. So having said that about the different types of gear, because you can really go either way on that, and I'm actually trying to veer away from gear-specific recommendations, whether Canon, Nikon, or anything. But a good starting out camera, if you don't want to spend too much money, because that's going to be the other factor, of course, is financial. You know, what kind of financial obligation you want to take. I like the 50D for an entry-level camera, and I like the 7D for an entry-level camera on the Canon line in terms of SLRs. They both produce amazing pictures. The thing for me that I think, if I had to choose between those two, for me personally, I would choose the 7D simply because the 7D can do video. But she's not really asking about video, or they, I should say, because we don't know if it's Amanda or Anne. Yeah.
We don't know.
But anyway.
But that's a good point. And that's one thing that I would touch on, in that they are asking, they say for nature type and animals. And if you want to shoot wildlife, then the 8 frames a second on the 7D was very welcome.
Yes. Frame rate is a huge thing to consider, too. So, yeah, if you're going to be doing more wildlife that's more fast moving, you're going to want to have a faster frame rate. That would be a consideration, sure.
Yeah, plus the crop factor, if you're going to, because lenses, to get really long lenses, it can cost you a lot of money. But if you get even a 70 to 200 on a 7B, because of the 1.6 times crop factor, you're going to get like 100 to, what is it, more, maybe. I haven't used a crop factor for so long. So 70 times 1.6, I don't know, 120, and then you're going to be out to 320 on the long end.
That sounds right.
So 320 on the long end, that's a relatively, if you're not talking about small birds, then 320, that will get you relatively far. And plus, if you use a 1.4 extender, it takes you out even further.
Right. Because you'd have the crop factor of 1.6 to 1.4, so you're looking at three times. You could have almost a 600. Now, you are going to be increasing noise.
Right. Well, not noise. It'll start to decrease the image quality, but I know that it's relatively expensive compared to the original version, but I just bought the new version of the 70-200, and it actually works admirably with 1.4 times extender, and it's even usable with the 2 times extender, which was just out of the question on the old version.
Yeah, I don't like the 2x extenders myself. Those, I personally found there was too much light loss in those, because that's the other thing to consider when you have extenders is they're going to slow things down. So if you've got a lens that's got a 2.8 aperture on it, once you throw that extender on there, it's going to decrease your aperture size where you can't get to that 2.8.
Well, yeah, you're going to have, with a 1.4, you're going to go to f4, and if you put a 2 times on it, you're going to go to f5.6. That's acceptable with a 2.8 lens. It's if you're in the right conditions. If you're in a slightly darker conditions or light is the problem, then obviously, that's something that you've got to bear in mind. Right. It's not ideal, but ideally, a nice longer lens, a 100 to 400 is a good lens for these for wildlife.
Yeah.
But outdoor nature, you're still going to want to have something a little bit wider as well. So, and with the 7D being a crop factor, it uses the EFS lenses, the short back lenses. So you can get some relatively cheap but very good quality lenses for that. But I would say the 7D is a good place to start.
And the reason why I went with the crop factor was not only because of the crop Zoom that you're going to get from, but also because you can, like you said, coincide with the EFS lens line, because if you're out doing nature and wildlife, you may want that panorama scene. So, you know, so you've got this small fox, like you said, in a big, huge open field. You know, the size of the field could be relevant to the size of the fox, and a wide-angle lens would be a really good thing to have. And my wide-angle lens, which is the EFS 10 to 22 that Canon puts out, that's only compatible with the crop factor lenses. So you can put that on a 20D, a 30D, 40D, 50D, 7D, up to the 7D, but you can't put this on the full frame.
Right.
So that's something to consider, is if you're going to be using a crop factor camera or a full frame camera. Now, if you wanted to start out with, if you're talking about starting out with a full frame, I'm not sure you would. But if you were starting out with a full frame, I'd say go with the 5D Mark II. That would be my preference for starting out with that, just because it's not as much of a financial commitment as some of the other ones that are out there, like the 1D Mark IVs. That's a lot of money. That's a lot of money for a body.
that's certainly true. And the other thing to bear in mind there is that if you think that in the future you might upgrade to a full, well, I don't know if it's definitely necessarily an upgrade, but if you want to move to a full-frame sensor later, then you want to avoid the EFS lenses to begin with.
Right.
Because you'll end up rebuying them. You'll have to replace them when you go to a full-size sensor.
Exactly. And for what it's worth, from my perspective, I have shot pretty much exclusively on the crop factor sensors. I have used a few full-frame ones when I've rented them, and I have been very limited in what I've been able to use when I've shot with the full-frame. So with that in mind, I would also probably mentioned that you want to be aware of where you are and where you want to be when you buy your glass.
Yeah.
Because that's what most people are going to tell you to spend most of your money anyways. You know, don't worry about the bodies, because the body's going to change over time.
Yeah.
You know, as bodies come and go, because you see more bodies being introduced every year than you do lenses.
Right. It used to be that you used to get like 5, 10, 15 years out of a body, but now they... Now, I've still got my old film body from like 19 years ago, but I haven't got any of the initial DSLRs that I bought just 8 years ago.
They've become disposable. They really have.
Right.
So, and having said that, if you're talking about a good starting camera, on the crop factor side, I'd say the Canon 7D. On the full frame side, I'd say the 5D Mark II.
Yeah. If they really want, because Amanda Starr says just starting out. They call them kisses here in Japan, but T2i is that one. They're incredible cameras for what they are. The reason that I agreed with the 7D is because of the frame rate. So if you really are interested in shooting animals, then a faster frame rate will be beneficial.
Right.
And the 7D is not gonna really break the bank these days. It's a relatively cheap body.
Right. And that actually kind of ties into another good point, that there's, in my mind anyway, there's three different grades of camera bodies. To me, there's entry-level camera bodies, enthusiast camera bodies, and then professional-grade camera bodies. So for someone who's just starting out, you may want to look at the KISS line or the Rebel line, as it is here in the States, where it's the T2i or the 1TI or whatever the entry models are these days. I don't remember the, because like you said, they change every year, so it's hard to keep up with those. And that may be a good starting out lens, but you're going to find yourself changing out too soon from that line, I'm afraid, if you go and jump in at that point. And they're only like $500, and I say $500 is a lot of money, but if you're going to spend $500 on a body, and you're going to spend $500 on at least one additional lens, because you're going to get the kit 18 to 55 IS, which it's an okay lens, but you're not going to be able to shoot wildlife with it, that's for sure. So you're going to have to spend a little bit of money. And if you're going to spend a little bit of money, you're going to want to get something that can at least do what you initially want it to do.
Right.
And I'm afraid for the landscape and the wildlife that she's talking about, or they're talking about, the entry-level camera grades, the Rebel line or the KISS line, probably would not be up to speed as far as the expectations go. So that's why I'd say...
Definitely for animals. If they're moving, you want the frame rate.
You got to have the frame rate. Landscapes
would probably be fine, but you don't have mirror lock on... I don't know if it's there now. I think it might be. Originally, you didn't have mirror lock up on the very base.
Yeah.
And that without that, shooting landscapes is not as good as, not going to be as good as you'd hope. But either way, I mean, I think we definitely agree. The 7D is the best place to jump in with these requirements.
Mm-hmm. I would definitely agree with that as well. So that's going to wrap things up for this episode of Learning Digital Photography. It's been a long episode, but hopefully you found the content worthwhile. I found it very interesting to share this episode with Martin. Martin, thank you very much for stopping and talking with us on the show. Where can we find you? Because we've mentioned your workshops. We've mentioned martinbilleyphotography.com and mbpworkshops.com. But you sent me a couple other things because you've got a blog that you blog on. He's a fellow blogger. Yeah. Just to let you know, Martin is not only a photographer. He's also a podcaster. He also is a blog author. He's leading workshops. And you've got an amazing number of resources. Your main website is Martin Bailey Photography, correct?
Right.
Where's your blog? Is your blog on that thing too?
If you go to martinbaileyphotography.com, there's like a sliding door menu at the top there, and there's a link to pretty much everything I'm into.
Okay. Then we'll just go ahead and link everyone to your main website at Martin Bailey Photography. Right. You can find his blog, podcast.
The other big resource there, though, and I've been podcasting since like 2005, I think it is. I've got like 400 and. Almost 450 podcast episodes in the archive. Sorry, 250.
Wow.
archives. Podcast in the archives. So, I mean, I was like, when I started podcasting, there was only Chris Marquardt doing Digital Tips from the Top Floor. And there was Brooks Jensen doing Lens Work. They were the only two podcasts that I could find. I started doing mine, it was a good 5 years ago. Actually, it's coming up to 5 years ago.
Oh, well, happy anniversary. That's very cool. So for those of you that are on the Learning Digital Photography podcast, go listen to Martin Bailey over on his podcast, which you can find off of his website, martinbaileyphotography.com. I think it's forward slash podcast, isn't it? I think it's /podcast at the end is the actual URL.
It's linked from the top page.
Yeah, just go to the top page, Martin Bailey Photography. We'll link to it in the show notes. Martin, again, thanks.
It is, if you want to just search for Martin Bailey or Martin Bailey Photography in iTunes, then I release it as an MP3 audio only and as an enhanced podcast. So
okay, cool.
You can get it in iTunes as well.
And are you on Twitter as well?
I am. Twitter.com/ Martin Bailey. One word, no spaces or anything.
If you want to give him a shout out, it's at Martin Bailey over on the TweetDeck and Twydroid and all the Twitter applications that are out there. What about Facebook? Do you have a Facebook presence as well?
I've got a Facebook a page and my own profile. Again, though, there's a social networking link or links at the bottom of the martinbaileyphotography.com website.
So we'll just do everything there and leave it at that. Martin, again, thank you so much for coming on the show. It was a lot of fun talking to you. I appreciate you. Wow, we've been talking for like 2 hours now almost. So hopefully people are still listening at this point in the show.
It'll surprise me if anyone's still around, but if you are, thank you, Jason. Thanks for having me on. I'm glad we finally managed to get our schedules to meet, and it's been a lot of fun.
Been a lot of fun. All right, well, take care. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in, and we'll catch you next time here at Learning Digital Photography.